working. And if you remember the past weeks, I always had trouble with my monitor output due to some mysterious reason which escapes me currently. It's working, which is good. Okay, without much further ado, let's start with the lecture. I think we left off here last week, right? And after the lecture, some of you asked me, wait. How can we build a torus network with fixed length cables? And I didn't want to answer this because I wanted to keep it for this lecture, but since not every one of you was here when I actually did explain, let's repeat this. So as you can see here, this donut-shaped object represents a two-dimensional torus, not a three-dimensional. But as you remember, BlueJean has at least the first instantiations had a three-dimensional torus network. So if I draw a three-dimensional torus network, it would probably look something like this, like a cube. Now, when I'm trying to connect the opposing sides of the cube, I somehow need longer cables, right? Now, the question is, if my system gets really big, these long cables, basically the signals running through those, even if I'm using fiber, the signal can at most move at light speed, right? So at some point, these long cables will limit my network latency and thus also the size of my system. So the question is, how can I build a torus network, especially a 3D or more dimensional torus network, without these long cables? And the key to that construction is actually we'll first build a one-dimensional torus. And from this one-dimensional torus with fixed length cables, we'll build a two-dimensional and then a three-dimensional torus. So the naive construction of a one-dimensional torus would look like this. I'll start with my nodes from 0 to 5. And it will always connect nearest neighbors and the opposing sides. And again, we have this problem here, which we don't want to have. So an alternative way of constructing this would be to split the two node sets into two halves and say, OK, we're starting here with 0, continue with 1, 2, and then have the other half interleave with that in a reverse order. So by this construction scheme, I always have to skip one node when connecting the first nodes, and then again when moving backwards. The drawback of this is obviously that most cables are slightly longer. They are now not just one single node distance, but two node distances. But actually, this is an upper limit. I never need a cable which is longer than the distance between two nodes. And by interleaving those nodes, I can still build a ring or a one-dimensional torus, which is nothing else than a ring of nodes. But if I can build a 1D torus network, I can use the same technique to build a two-dimensional torus by simply interleaving not just on the x-axis, but also on the y-axis. Yeah, I won't draw all the connections because then probably the lecture would be over, but just a brief illustration. If we assume that these are always one-dimensional torus, what's the plural form of torus? Tori? I don't know. So the connection would probably look a bit like this in the y direction. And as you can imagine, if I can build two-dimensional planes of torus networks, then I can also build three-dimensional cubes. Any questions to this? Actually, that's how I thought they would be constructing networks. So I'm not sure if they actually build networks like this, but it's one possibility. Okay, next in line, the Hypercube network. The Hypercube network has one advantage. It sounds really cool. It has one disadvantage. If you add more nodes to the network, you typically don't have a constant out degree. So I would say let's just start with an example. A zero-dimensional hypercube is simply one node. When I'm now constructing a hypercube of higher order, I will just take the original hypercube or the hypercube of one lesser order, copy it, and then connect all corresponding nodes. So this would be now a hypercube of order one. If we continue this, again, we'll copy the hypercube and then connect all corresponding nodes. And of course, I can now continue this. This is also the reason why it's called hypercube, because at some point it actually looks like a cube. So this would be a three-dimensional hypercube, but we can even go beyond that. I will now use an alternative color. I won't go beyond a four-dimensional hypercube because that's already complicated enough. Okay, I think that should already be it. Any further edges missing? Okay, so we can already see the disadvantage I was hinting at before. The higher the order of this graph gets, the more edges I need per node, which can be costly. Usually, if you build network hardware, you will have a fixed out fan out. So you won't have unlimited numbers of connections going out. The advantage is that typically between different nodes, I have a lot of different routes to choose from. So you can easily build a network which has just few collisions. So if you need short paths or short distances between any two nodes, this is probably a good solution. It scales better than the crossbar. As you remember, for the full crossbar, we would need n squared cables. And for the hypercube, we just need O of, what do you think, which complexity class is this in? Now, is the question too easy or too difficult? I'm with how many cables do I need in terms of nodes? If I have n nodes, how many cables will I probably approximately need? So let's take a look at the number of nodes here. I know each node or each vertex of this graph is one. And let's take a look at how many cables go out of each node. So in this case, that's 1, 2, 3, 4. And I said this is a 4D hypercube. Sorry? Okay, D times N, exactly. So, but we can even express D through N because we know, in this case, I wrote K for the dimension, but it doesn't really matter. So I know that 2 to the power of, sorry, D. Again, this is some of the blackboard here is greasy, so you can't really write on this part. Equals N. So I can rewrite this as So this is the logarithm dualis from D. So I can just say this is O of n log n. So that's for large numbers, the logarithm is almost constant. So this is much better than this one. But still, the fan out can sometimes, depending on your technology, really hinder you. I'm just thinking about any example of supercomputer which was using a hypercube. But actually, right now, I don't know anyone. Do you know anyone? Maybe I can look that up. OK, moving on. Another topology is the closed network, which should remind you of the Roadrunner system, because the Roadrunner system had a similar switch topology. In this case, the network typically consists of input and output ports. And the reason for that is this closed topology was not initially built for computer networks, but it was built for telephone systems. Because if you imagine a telephone system, do you know how they were initially structured? Usually, or if you watch older movies, sometimes people would pick up the telephone and say, "Hallo Vermittlung," or "Hello operator," which never happens if you pick up a phone today, right? Because there's no operator. Back then, each house that had a telephone connection would be connected to the operator. And then some person would be sitting here and would answer your call and say, OK, I will connect you. So there was one huge crossbar where each incoming connection basically had a short cable, and each outgoing connection had a port. And you could then connect the incoming connection to the outgoing port so that, for instance, the caller in this house could actually talk to the person in this house. Do you know any place in Germany where a similar system is still in use? The Bundeswehr. When I was doing military service, we actually had communication equipment which was not the same as they used in World War II, but almost the same. And the telephone system was one of those. So if you were to build a telephone connection in the field, then one would get a wire, and basically it was a backpack with a huge wire, how you call it, a wire box on your back with 400 meters of cable. And then you would just go wherever you need to go. If you need to go more than 400 meters, then your colleague would have another wire on his back, and then you would connect the wires in the field and then move another 400 meters until you made that connection. So naturally, these phones, because we are in the field, they were really just very simple phones. They did not have any dial, because you just took off the receiver and talked to the operator. Obviously, the operator was not sitting in a fancy house, but somewhere in some puddle of mud. And the problem here is, if you have a lot of connections, then, and this is a full crossbar, it needs to be really big, right? It's the same problem as we had with the Earth simulator. So people were thinking, OK, this full crossbar here, that's probably going to be a problem. And actually, when the telephone system was still new, people said it won't ever be possible for everyone to have a telephone in the United States, because that would mean that more than half of the population would be working as operators, because you need so many people operating the phones. Now, we all know that was probably not so true. And one reason for this is that we are no longer using full crossbars for making the connections. And one solution to this problem, not the only or not the complete solution, but one solution to this problem is the closed network. Because this shows us basically it's an architecture which saves us operators, or if we are using automated switches, which saves us hardware. And the reason why this works is you can actually prove that you can have a fully non-blocking connection from each incoming to each outgoing port if the size of your intermediate layer switches satisfies a certain condition, which we won't go through in this case, right? There's a paper with the complete proof, but it's probably beyond the scope of this lecture. Basically, what you should know is you have incoming ports. Each line here is connected to a single subscriber, and these switches here are full crossbars each, but smaller crossbars, right? And each incoming node is connected to each inbound switch is connected to each intermediate switch, and each intermediate switch is connected to each outgoing switch. Usually you have the same number of input and output ports and input and output switches, and the number of switches in the middle differs. As I said, there is a proof that if M is larger than 2N minus 1, where M is the number of switches here, then you can prove that there is a fully non-blocking pattern to connect all input and output ports. Of course, always assuming that not two inbound connections want to reach the same output port. The advantage of this network is basically that you again have a very flat hierarchy. You don't have something like a tree or like a torus network where two nodes may be very far away from each other. Also, the likelihood for collisions can be mitigated in this case, but again, you have to pay a certain kind of penalty by having lots of intermediate switches. And the more switches you add, the better the qualities of service can be, or the lower your latency or the higher your bandwidth can be. Yeah, and as I said, originally this was built for telephone systems, but it was reused for computer systems as well. Okay, so far we have talked a lot about architectures, network architectures, but to high-performance computing networks, there's more. There's not just, there's also the protocol side, right? We were mostly talking about hardware, but what's also important is the software side. Who of you knows the OSI model? Okay, that's good to know. It's usually standard content for computer science students, I think. So one benefit of the OSI model is to ensure compatibility, because the functionality of the whole network is broken down into layers. These layers are layered on top of each other, and each cares for different parts of the network, like the physical layer. I can ensure a data link layer where I can move basic data around, but don't know much about external routing. I have a network layer, for instance, IP. I can have a transport layer, which in the case of TCP gives me a virtual connection, and so on. So I can layer all these. The problem is this takes time. If I'm open a TCP connection and I don't care for the underlying hardware, I don't care if it is IP over InfiniBand, I don't care if it is Ethernet or probably DSL uplink, I'm probably paying some sort of abstraction cost. And actually what we can see here is it's not just typically slower than a real high-performance computing network, but there's also, because here I'm trading speed for security, there's also a fundamental difference. Because usually in my operating system, when I'm accessing hardware, a user code may never actually access the hardware, because there's no limit to what potential dangers a user code could then come into, right? Because if that is malicious code that could send malicious data through the network, and you typically don't want that. So usually your operating system will bar the user code from accessing hardware directly. On the other side, if I have a high performance computing system, I usually want exactly this. I want my MPI implementation or my message passing code to directly access the hardware, so I get the best possible speed. Do you know one of the problems, or what's the problem if I let just the kernel operate on the hardware? Exactly. So, yeah, and that's what makes it slow. If you have a context switch, you have to basically reconfigure parts of your processor, and that takes a lot of time. So, because in kernel mode, the processor is allowed to access hardware and memory in a different way than in user mode, and yeah, that takes valuable cycles of your time. So, other problems are, for instance, if I was using Ethernet, usually if I connect multiple switches, Ethernet switches, let's say I have one switch in my living room and one switch in my basement, and I have connected multiple machines to those switches, and let's assume here are two file servers, and I'm trying to stream data through one connection, then this connection might actually be a bottleneck. So I could now assume, well, let's set up multiple connections so I always have plenty of bandwidth here. But if you're using consumer-grade switches, what will typically happen is these switches will perform a spanning tree algorithm to find out which or to remove cycles from the network. So some of your links will actually be removed and won't be used. If you're using enterprise class switches, then you can manually configure the switches to use multiple links simultaneously to achieve a higher bandwidth. But usually, if you are using non-managed switches, then you won't be able to use those. Do you know why an Ethernet switch might want to eliminate cycles in the network? On the Ethernet layer, I'm just addressing each node through its MAC address. You probably know about this from your Ethernet hardware. Each Ethernet network interconnector has an MAC address, which you sometimes can modify. Sometimes commercial software will use the MAC address to bind your license to a specific node, which can be annoying if you have to swap out the Ethernet hardware. Do you know what MAC address what MAC stands for? I think it's media access code. I'm not so sure. However, each network card here on the network will be identified by a MAC address. Sometimes I need to find out which IP address belongs to a certain MAC address. Now, this is done through the ARP address resolution protocol, which is actually a broadcast. So one node will ask, okay, which MAC address has a certain IP address? And this will be broadcast from the switch to all outgoing ports. So in this case, let me use another color. In this case, the switch will broadcast the incoming ARP request to all outgoing ports. And each succeeding switch will also broadcast it to all outgoing ports, never to the port where the request came from. Now assume we actually had a circle here. Then this switch would send back the ARP request here, and because this switch is stupid and didn't remember that it had already sent this ARP request, it would then again broadcast it through this connection, and there would be a cycle without any end. This is one of the reasons why we usually use a spanning tree in Ethernet. But as I said before, we typically don't use Ethernet in high-performance computing setups. If you take a look at the top 500 list, you will still see a lot of systems which use Ethernet as the connection, which surprises me, actually, because to get on the top 500, you have to pay couple of million euros to build such a large system, but if you are already spending a couple of million euros, then you probably should be able to afford a couple tens of thousands of euros to build an InfiniBand network. But yeah. Speaking of InfiniBand.
How is this problem resolved by enterprise hardware?
Sorry?
How is this problem resolved by enterprise hardware?
Well, as far as I know, switchers will then just assume that multiple connections are one virtual connection and then interlace the packets on multiple links. Please. I think for the hypercube, it's also logarithmic of the number of nodes. Because the basically, what you can assume is that you can express each node as a bit string, which has as many bits as the hypercube has dimensions. So. So the now, if you consider any two nodes, then the largest difference in this bit string would be at most d bits, and that's simply logarithmic in the number of nodes. And by that, you can construct a route between two nodes, which has at most d hops. So it's logarithmic.
I think with trees, it should be possible to reach that with a constant altitude.
Yeah.
So the question is actually. Yeah.
Yes, they are. Advantage is what you just said. They have a fixed out degree, which is always beneficial because sometimes you can't just build hardware which has a out degree of 10 or so. Right? The question should rather be, are hypercubes at all used? Or why would you want to use a hypercube if you can achieve the same diameter with a tree network? And the answer to that is, you have more collisions in a tree network. In a tree network, your bottleneck will probably be the root. Because if the two partitions here try to talk to each other, this root will be overloaded. You can mitigate this by adding more cables here. Okay. So then it would be interesting how many cables you need for the butterfly graph. Okay, that's interesting. I'm just trying to make a note of that. Probably better on my notebook. Good, thanks. Okay, let's move on to the InfiniBand network. Any questions, by the way, regarding Ethernet, network, anything? Okay. Initially, InfiniBand was primarily targeted actually at connecting compute nodes or consoles and storage systems. And if you look at InfiniBand, at the InfiniBand architecture, you will see a lot of properties in the network which are actually beneficial to connecting storage nodes. So when I read about this and went to my first supercomputing conference, I was surprised to see that no storage vendor actually had InfiniBand adapters for their storage network, for their storage systems. They all had 10 gig Ethernet, and no one was offering InfiniBand. I was really surprised, but back then it was simply the standard for storage systems. So when you bought a cluster, you would usually use InfiniBand for networking the nodes and equip some of the nodes with 10 gig Ethernet to connect them to the storage system. And you can still see in many supercomputer designs that just some of the nodes have actual connection to the storage network. This is slowly changing. So you can probably imagine that it somehow doesn't really make sense for a system architect to have to equip some nodes with two network cards, one for talking just to the storage and one for talking just through the message passing network. And, so today, if you buy a storage system, you can usually also use InfiniBand to connect it to the network. One crucial difference in the architecture is in InfiniBand you have a switched fabric network. So you don't have a spanning tree, but instead you have some software. It used to be just a single node which would run the so-called subnet manager. Let's assume it's running, let's say, here on this processor node. And the subnet manager will then take a look at the topology of the switches and of the nodes and then set up routes so that each host channel adapter or target channel adapter knows through which route to send data. Usually these routes are set statically. And if you have a really large system, you can modify those routes, but usually the daemon, which will be running, will just do the right thing. A couple of years ago, if you were running two subnet managers on two different nodes, then all hell would break loose, because then suddenly your network would stop working, because those two daemons would conflict with each other. Today, it's actually a fallback solution. So usually, if you have a huge InfiniBand network, you will run multiple subnet managers on different nodes so that if one fails, the other one can take over seamlessly. Okay. Another thing which is important is you have one fixed maximum transfer unit, which you usually try to set as large as possible, but you have to watch out which hardware supports which MTU. It's not the same for every InfiniBand hardware. This is a huge difference to Ethernet or IP networks. If you have an IP network, the MTU does not have to be fixed across the whole network, which is actually beneficial, because if you consider the internet, which is basically just one huge IP network, you don't want to set the IP for the whole internet, the MTU for the whole internet, because that probably won't work, right? So IP has methods of fragmenting packets, so you can use different MTUs on different networks or different subnetworks. For InfiniBand, that's not possible. Each endpoint is not identified via an IP, but via local IDs and global IDs, which identify the host and the port on the host. But usually you don't have to think about that, because usually you won't ever program InfiniBand directly. Most people just program InfiniBand through MPI. A colleague of mine, Thomas Heller, took a look at InfiniBand, and you program it through the libibverbs. I think we have that on the next slide. We'll talk about programming later on. Another property of the InfiniBand hardware is it is backwards compatible, and progress is made in two directions. One direction is the lane speed. So they did start with SDR single data rate, DDR double data rate. So it's probably similar to what you know from RAM standards. QDR used to be the standard for years, and right now we are moving to FDR. So here on this slide you can see here FDR. Actually, FDR was planned to be rolled out in 2011. I think back then Mellanox had the first test hardware, and right now it's become the standard for a new system. So probably 3 years after it was initially released. The interesting thing is, Mellanox at this year's supercomputing conference announced 100G or 100 gigabits. Gigabits per second lane speed. but that probably won't be available, widely available, for another 3 years. Now, this is the speed of a single lane or a single link. But usually, if you have an InfiniBand cable, you don't have just a single link, but you have double wide or 4x or even 12x links. We have some spare 12x cables upstairs, so probably I can show you some tomorrow during the exercises. They are really thick, and they're really expensive. So if you want 1 meter of a 12x cable, you pay probably €400 around that line. The 4x cables, which are more commonly used, usually you use those 12x cables just to connect switches. The 4x cables are a bit cheaper, but you still pay a couple hundred of euros. Usually you can also get them in for longer distances. One interesting point is the encoding scheme. At least for QDR, they were using a 8-10 pull-down coding, which means you have 10 bits of code words. Let's say but actually, those 10 bits would be used just to encode 8 bits of usable data. And the reason for that is these 256 code words could be interweaved with the whole code table of 1K code words so that you can maximize the signal-to-noise ratio and also to optimize for high-frequency properties of the cable. As you can imagine, probably a pattern like 0000011111 will have different high frequency properties because of the resulting rectangular shape of the signal than some signal which is alternating between two states. And so this would correspond to and depending on how the high frequency properties of the cable actually are, some code words might be beneficial, some others don't. So the consequence of this is if I have a QDR network with 4x with a 4x cable, then this means that I would theoretically have 4 times 10 gigabits, but because of the 8-10 pull-down encoding, I only have not 40x but 32 gigabits of usable network bandwidth. They did change this encoding for FDR. I think for FDR they are using a 32 pull-down coding, so they still use just 2 bits. Two extra bits to optimize, but they're using, but they lose much less of the usable data. They don't lose 1/5 of the usable data, but just 1/16 of the usable bandwidth. Okay, so now we know a bit about the performance of InfiniBand. Let's take a brief look at how this is actually implemented. InfiniBand itself is built on the virtual interface architecture. I think that was some previous network standard. And this already abstracts away much of the connection handling. So basically, if I take a look at two nodes, then I have a send and a receive queue pair. And if I want to send data from this node to this node, I just put my data into the queue pair, in the send queue, and it will automatically be moved to the receive queue, at least hopefully. It doesn't always work like that, especially if I want to send more data than the InfiniBand hardware can actually chew or swallow. But basically, this is the idea. I also get remote direct memory access atomics, which means I can just specify to which address on the receiving side I want to write. But for this to work, the receiver has to post receive buffers. So it has to specify where it plans to receive data. And the InfiniBand hardware can actually write directly to the remote memory access, to the remote memory. This works because it's usually in PCI Express hardware, and PCI Express hardware can access the CPU's memory controller. This is a bit different from TCP sockets. Usually, if you have an IP network, InfiniBand usually does not use an IP. You have to manage TCP sockets and sessions yourself. And with InfiniBand, you just have to manage these queue pairs. So in a way, it's easier to program. But it's also easy to underestimate. So if you look at if you look at MPI implementations and you look at the InfiniBand code, it typically looks more complicated than you would imagine it has to be. So one colleague of mine, Thomas Heller, went ahead and said he's working on HPX, which is in parallel runtime for C++, and this runtime also has to have a network layer where it moves bytes basically from one node to another. And it can utilize different types of networks, and when they decided to add InfiniBand to the list of supported networks, they had to write a byte transport layer for InfiniBand. And they initially went ahead and used the libibverbs to do this. And for ibverbs, ibverbs is basically a user mode library which gives you, at least to a limited degree, direct access to the hardware through memory mapping. And yeah, it did look simple at first, but I think in the end he settled to just move the data not through libibverbs directly, but through MPI. Because in the end, even the seemingly simple operations get complicated if you try to program InfiniBand directly. And that's one of the reasons why pretty much no one is programming InfiniBand directly, but mostly through MPI. Let me take a brief look. Yeah, so how do you actually program InfiniBand? We know that we can access those queue pairs. One benefit is usually you achieve zero copy communication and low latency. This zero copy communication is actually important. What happens is, let's imagine I have one node here, and this is the RAM of one node. And let's imagine this node wants to send data, which it has in its RAM somewhere, to the remote node, to this region in the RAM. So this is node 0. And this is node 1. If I was using TCP/IP, what would happen is usually the operating system kernel would take a copy of this data internally, this data would then be copied over to the network card, the network interface client. On the remote side, the data would have to traverse again the NIC. Possibly, this might go through an additional buffer, depends really on your driver setup. And then it would be move to another buffer. It really depends on how you do the receive. Sometimes you have a user-defined buffer, then you move it to the target destination, or sometimes it can be directly moved here. What that means is you have a lot of additional copies here on the send and on the receive node. InfiniBand can actually get rid of these additional copies by just moving data directly from the send buffer to the receive buffer. Usually, an operating system can't do this because you have a virtual address space, and the pages here in which the data is might be swapped. So you can never let the network card directly read this data. What InfiniBand does, it will usually pin the data you're trying to send. Pinning means it can't be swapped. If some data can't be swapped, that actually sounds like a good thing, right? Because if it can't be swapped out to hard disk, it won't. Your computer won't be slow. The drawback of this is, let's say you have a Firefox running with 300 tabs like I have, which is really bad because it consumes a lot of memory, and you typically don't want that memory to sit around in your RAM. You want that to be swept out. So if an application would never be swept out, this would never work, at least not on a general purpose system. But this is high performance computing, and we assume that applications on a high performance computing system never allocate more RAM than they really need to. This is why it's an invalid assumption that InfiniBand drivers can actually pin the network, than the RAM you're using here. And if it can't be swapped out, you can give the physical address to the hardware. And then the hardware can read this data, communicate it directly, and on the receiving side, this RAM has also needs also to be pinned. There are two different ways in InfiniBand or in MPI to achieve this. Either you can use special allocation functions to tell MPI, okay, this RAM which I'm allocating here is never to be swapped out, so please pin it immediately. Or what you can also do is you can rely on MPI's auto magic. So sometimes if you're sending lots of large buffers, MPI will, depending on the implementation, obviously, but I know at least from the OpenMPI implementation, that it can detect which buffers you are using frequently and leave those be pinned. Okay, this is a brief overview of the IBVerbs class which you have. So some of the verbs are, basically you can think of a verb as a function which you can trigger. Some of those are concerned with managing queue pairs, some are concerned with memory management, which you need for remote direct memory access. You have multicasts, memory allocation. So you don't have to remember those again, right? This is just a brief overview of what you can do with InfiniBand, how the API basically looks like. And I'm trying to convince you that it's more complicated than you would imagine. So never use InfiniBand directly. Always use a library which does this for you. One is, of course, MPI, but there are different other layers on top of network hardware like portals. So if you Google for InfiniBand abstraction library, you will find plenty of those. But usually, the MPI implementations are the fastest. Speaking of which, let's talk a bit about MPI. Who of you has ever used MPI? Okay, almost everyone, so we can probably speed through this a bit. And we got plenty of time, that's good. First question, why would I ever use MPI? When I was studying computer science, and one of my first years, people told me MPI has been around for the past 2 decades or even longer. It probably won't be around for much longer because its design is so old and it's getting complicated to write applications with it. And now it's 1 decade later and MPI is still around. So if anyone tells you that MPI is old and therefore it will be forgotten, don't trust them. The thing is, the reason is MPI is not being thrown out because it is actually a good API or because people love it, because most people do not really love it. The reason is there's so much code written for MPI that you basically can't throw that out. The oldest thing in high-performance computing is usually not the hardware, because that's always brand new. It's also not the libraries, because they can be rewritten, but it's really the application codes. The application codes may be older than we are. Some of the codes have received investments in the order of tens of millions, sometimes even hundreds of millions, if you consider all the manpower put into that. And there's just no thinking that these codes will ever be thrown away. Sometimes they will be re-implemented, but that again means a huge or substantial investment. So backwards compatibility in high-performance computing, even though this may sound ironic, is very important. That's because people will always be using MPI. But back to the question, why are we using MPI? The reason is supercomputers are no longer huge monolithic machines. That used to be the case for older Cray hardware, where you basically had just one huge machine which had one huge shared address space. But today, you usually have off-the-shelf, probably not off-the-shelf hardware, but still you have distinct nodes which are connected through the network. So if I wanted to classify my systems, I could on the one hand say shared memory systems here. Shared memory systems have one global address space, and I can classify those as either uniform memory access machines, where each processor has the same latency, the same bandwidth of access to all regions of the memory. Then I have, of course, if I have uniform memory access, I have non-uniform memory access, where I can basically have local memory nodes which are slower to access from remote CPUs. And do you know what this CC means here? Exactly, so that's cache coherent non-uniform memory access. And usually all PC systems which have multiple sockets today, they are cache coherent non-uniform memory access systems. The drawback of this is if I want to ensure cache coherence, then I basically have to let every CPU core snoop on at least the level three cache bus of any other CPU core. So I can keep the caches coherent. And this limits my scalability because that's basically an end-to-end connection. Okay, so if you're today reading about many core designs, and sometimes you will read about startups which offer systems with hundreds of CPU cores, those systems will usually not be cache coherent, because if it was so easy to ensure cache coherence, then Intel would have done it first. They have just more money. Okay. Now, these are shared memory systems, but as far as I know, all of the top 500 systems are distributed memory machines, which means I have shared memory on the node level, but I have multiple nodes, and those are just networked. There are vendors who sell network cards, which implement some kind of virtual global address space. I think there's even a German vendor whose name is currently escaping me. That hardware is typically one order of magnitude more expensive than InfiniBand hardware. So few people actually buy that. Now, the drawback of distributed memory systems is you have to synchronize data manually. Especially if you're using MPI, you have to control all movement of data yourself, which can be annoying. Some say that this is harder to program, but my experience is if you really try to get to the optimum, if you try to max out performance, then the optimizations you have to do on the node level, let's say with intelligent synchronization, with probably even manual threading, those can actually be harder than the synchronization via MPI. So I don't think we yet have an API which actually makes parallel programming easy. Whenever you try to max it out, it gets complicated. It's the same with MPI, it's the same with OpenMP, it's the same with CUDA. It always gets complicated, which is actually a good thing, because if you are a software engineer for high-performance computing, it's pretty unlikely that you will ever be unemployed, right? Because the current trend we are seeing is that parallel computing systems get more and more complicated. Even though tool support is also getting better, it can't really keep up, right? The hardware we are seeing gets more heterogeneous, it gets more complicated, and I think there will always be demand for people who know how to tune for performance. Okay. Now, so if I embrace the fact that my huge parallel computer will have some kind of network connection which I have to program through. I have to think of some interface through which I can program on this. If you have a software engineering background like I have, then you would probably think of CORBAR or XML RPC, or even of, do you know what JRMI means? That's a Java Remote Method Invocation. That's typical for software engineers, because software engineers always use Java. And I also, there was a time when I did really like Java until I learned C++, then my affinity to Java slightly declined. Okay, so as I said, RMI means a remote method invocation. RPC is basically the same remote procedure call. But some say that procedures are inferior to methods because methods are attached to objects. So one would never call something Java remote procedure call because Java is object oriented, right? Okay. The advantage of these frameworks is most are XML based. They are. We got time. I'm just glad that it wasn't on my mobile phone, because usually it's my mobile phone. Okay, so what I was trying to say is these standards here are actively used in lots of applications, but they are typically not found in high-performance computing networks, not found in high-performance computing environments. The reason for that is they are compatible, they are well standardized, but they are slow. They have lots of overhead. Usually you won't feel that overhead if you're running on a web server, or at least you will assume you won't see it until your web server is actually maxed out. But yeah, MPI is simply much more tuned for performance, but at the cost of security, at the cost of compatibility. So if you're using MPI, all participating nodes have to use the same MPI implementation. You cannot just run some nodes with OpenMPI and some others with MPage, because they are not compatible on the binary layer. There's one drawback of MPI. When I was learning high-performance computing, there was actually a competition, PVM, which had one advantage. It was MPI is just a specification. It's just an API specification. It does not specify how it works on a binary layer. But PVM, the parallel virtual machine, was both a standard and an implementation. So you always had code which you could run, and it even had some benefits. You could, at runtime, add nodes to the code or to the running instance or to the job, and you could also remove nodes from the running job, which is something MPI still can't do. Even 15 years later, I think even 20 years after PVM could do that, still MPI cannot do this, which is becoming a huge problem, because if you assume you have a huge system with, say, 20,000 nodes, and you assume that each node will fail, let's say, just every 3 years, you can calculate that the whole system, if you're running a job on all nodes simultaneously and your job will crash if one node crashes, then this whole system will crash every couple of hours. And that's bad. So one drawback currently of MPI is that it's not really fault tolerant. If you Google MPI fault tolerance, you will find papers back from the 90s, I think. And still it's not working. And yeah, it's becoming an increasing problem. And everyone's fed up about MPI not being able to handle fault tolerance. Actually, the problem is fault tolerance can probably not be contained in the message passing layer itself. You always have to have some sort of user-level fault reaction. So sometimes your numerical method will be able to just ignore some data which is being used. Sometimes it has to actively recover it from a snapshot. But that's probably yet too far. Okay. Yep, please.
Then, why did MPI became the standard and not PVM?
I don't know. Probably they had better marketing. But one interesting thing is, earlier this year, I've been to a conference. I probably did tell you from this. It was called Euro MPI. It's a conference which is always in Europe and which is concerned with MPI and parallel codes, but mostly with MPI. This year, this Euro MPI conference was in Kyoto. So they did call it Euro MPI / Asia. Which is interesting because not many years ago, this Euro MPI conference was called Euro PVM MPI. And it was called that way for years and years. And even after PVM fell out of fashion, they kept the name for historic reasons. And I think 3 or 4 years ago, people became so embarrassed of PVM because no one even knew what PVM was, so they just dropped the PVM from the name and henceforth called it Euro MPI. Well, until last year when they called it, or this year when they called it Euro MPI Asia. I'm not sure where it will be in 2015, so maybe then it will be called Euro MPI Australia or so. Should be interesting. Yeah, but good reason. I think there's no single reason why PVM fell out of fashion. I think, as far as I know, MPI was at some point outperforming PVM because PVM was also always an implementation, so it was just one implementation. And for MPI, each vendor had its own implementation, so vendors could compete. And I think that was a reason why MPI was faster. And in high-performance computing, if something is offering you a performance benefit, it's likely that you will adopt that and drop the other one. I'm not sure if this is the single explanation why PVM fell out of fashion, because as I said, from a programming point of view, I did like it better, but it might have contributed. But I should try to find that out. Okay. Now, I said that MPI is not a implementation, but there are multiple implementations, and the MPI standard is really is really just an API standard. So what does the standard define? It really just defines what needs to be done, but not how. So how that happens is implementation detail. So if you read the standard is actually hard to stomach. And the Hochleistungsrechenzentrum Stuttgart, the HLRS, will always publish a new book when a new MPI standard comes out. And usually you can get those books for free at conferences. If HLRS has the booth there, you can always get a book there. Sometimes they will charge you a couple of euros because they have to cover their printing costs and they don't want people to take home 20 of those books because they have to fix dangling tables or something like that. But yeah, it's interesting to look at, but it's hard to stomach. As I said before, we have multiple competing implementations like Intel MPI, Hewlett-Packard MPI, IBM MPI. Usually the MPI folks will say that Hewlett-Packard is actually a printer company, but there was a time when Hewlett-Packard had more systems in the top 500 than IBM. So Hewlett-Packard would say, well, we are probably a printer company, but still we got more printers in the top 500 than IBM. To which IBM would reply, well, but if you look at the top 10 systems, they are almost all ours, and there's no Hewlett-Packard system in the top 10, and so that would continue forever. Intel was happy that everyone was using Intel hardware. Okay, so each vendor has its own implementation. There's also a Cray MPI. There's an Open MPI, which is actually being run by a Cisco employee, Jeff Squires. There is Ampage. OpenMPI and Ampage are both the major open source projects. One variant of Ampage is mvarpage, which was, I think, initially a port of Ampage to InfiniBand. So if you remember that InfiniBand is built on the virtual interface architecture, I think this VA here stems from that virtual interface architecture. But of course, today, Ampage can also use InfiniBand, so I'm not sure which is the actual difference between those. A couple of years ago, there was also a LAM MPI, but I think that's no longer maintained. I'm not sure about that. One interesting point is, if you take a look at these vendor MPI solutions, I think every one of them is based on Ampage. So even though they claim, oh, this is our own MPI implementation, internally they are using Ampage. And Ampage has a liberal license, so it's not GPL, so they can actually reuse that code without having to open source it. Now, as I said before, competition and at least open source for two projects meant we had a fast evolution. And if you are on one of the major project mailing lists, for instance, on OpenMPI, they would typically monitor Ampage performance very closely. And if they see that there's some test case where Ampage is faster than OpenMPI, they will try to figure out how Ampage is doing that, take a look at the hot code path, and try to mimic that behavior. So at least between the open source projects, there's very tough competition. Of course, this also applies to the vendors, because usually a huge vendor will make a contract with a buyer for a certain target performance. They typically don't make contracts where they sell, okay, we are selling you 1,000 nodes. This is probably what they would do for smaller systems, but for large systems, they would say, okay, we'll build you a system which delivers so and so many gigalattice updates for that software. And if they manage to build that system with fewer nodes, they make profit. So this is one reason why vendors are interested in tuning MPI themselves so they can max out the performance for the hardware they are selling. As I said before, implementations are not binary compatible. So whenever you're using a different MPI implementation, you have to recompile your code, which is absolutely horrible for commercial code. Right? So there's not much commercial software which is actually using MPI because it's difficult to ship. On the one hand, MPI is tightly bound to the hardware which you are using. On the other hand, if you're using if you're trying to ship a commercial software for which you don't want to publish the source code, then you have to already compile it against, compile with and link against a certain implementation of MPI. And it's not very likely that the implementation you're using will be the same as some user would be using, because that, again, depends on the hardware the user's using. So for a commercial vendor, the only choice is either to compile the commercial code against all supported MPI versions, which is huge overhead, which takes a lot of manpower, or at least should take just once a lot of manpower, because afterwards it's automated. But if you want to test it, it still takes a lot of resources. So if you take a look at commercial software, it's very rare that it will be using MPI. And if it's using MPI, they typically will just list one version of MPI, one vendor, one version, or one release for which it's supported. But this is really a drawback of MPI adoption in commercial software. But then again, most scientific software is not commercial software, so a lot of that software is open source, and you can just recompile it. One artifact from the old times was that if you're using MPI, you have to use a wrapper compiler to compile your code. Usually this wrapper compiler won't do much magic. It will just add some include flags, some linker flags to your compile command line, and then use whatever C or C++ or Fortran compiler you meant to use. But there were some compilers which went beyond that. So So today you could typically say, I don't have to use the MPICC wrapper compiler. I could just use my usual compiler and add the linker and compile flex myself. So I think today it's even standardized by MPI how you can use the wrapper compiler to yield the linker and include flex it would add. But theoretically, as defined by the standard, this wrapper compiler could do whatever transformation you would want to do. And the basic paradigm behind MPI is I have a single program, and each instance is working on different data, and I'm communicating through MPI to synchronize those and to define which rank is which is working on which fraction of the data. So MPI gives me, I won't run now through all MPI functions because I think all MPI functions are a couple hundred. You can quickly take a look. It doesn't have to be large enough for you to read. I just want to show you. Okay, this is a list of all MPI functions. This is not strictly a small interface, but the functions are somewhere around the order of 350 functions which you could use. So one reason for this is for each function, there are different variants. So for instance, if I take a look at MPI send, there's also a buffered send, there's a non-blocking send, an isend. So for each function, I can have different prefixes and different postfixes, which basically multiplies the number of functions. Yeah, but if I wanted to categorize these functions, then I could say I have functions for point-to-point communication, synchronous or non-blocking. Actually, the correct term here is not asynchronous, because asynchronous implies that there is some kind of asynchronous progress. Usually, MPI won't do this asynchronous progress, but we'll talk about that later. Collective communication. This shows the age of my slides because I did make those slides before MPI standard 3.0 was released. With MPI 3.0, we also now have non-blocking collective functions. We also have barriers, remote memory access, and also parallel output or parallel input and output. This MPI I/O, if you take a look at MPI implementations, pretty much every MPI implementation is using Romeo, which is the de facto implementation for MPI I/O. I think every MPI implementation is using Romeo. And they are just always, if there's a new Romeo release, each MPage, each OpenMPI implementation will just copy over the Romeo release and adapt it to its current trunk. But which is interesting, because I said before that in MPI you have different implementations and therefore you have competition. But for the parallel I/O part, there's no competition because everyone's using the same code. I'm not sure what the reason is. My assumption is parallel I/O always seems easy, but essentially it's very difficult to do good. And because no one wants to go through this pain again, they just use the same code and be done with it. Okay, you can also do other stuff, like define your own data types. You can use different communicators. Actually, it's good practice to use different communicators in MPI to encapsulate the way you are communicating and to avoid collisions with other libraries which might be using MPI simultaneously. And even though, or perhaps because it's good practice, no one's using that. So if you look at actual MPI codes, actual scientific codes, you will see horrible things, and usually you will ask yourself, why are people doing this? And the reason is because they don't have time to do it properly. Many of the scientific codes were written by grad students or by research staff who never really have time to rewrite a code properly, which means that a code might be in existence for decades, and people just add exceptions or special cases to the code to make it work or to make it do new things with minimal impact. So there's very rarely funding to modernize a code. That's very rare. Actually, I'm also involved in a code modernization effort for a simulation software in the US. Did I tell you about the AdCirc project? Okay. Well, maybe we'll find a couple of minutes later on. What I wanted to say is a lot of codes are using MPI badly. So there are also a lot of codes which could use parallel IO but don't because it's somewhat difficult to program for. And let me think about this. I would now like to show you an example of how MPI is being used. This is a quick ring communication code, but I don't think we would have enough time to both write the code and test it. So I was hinting before that there is horrible code out there. As you know, I've been the mentor to the student cluster competition team from our university for the past 2 years. And one thing we were actually surprised by was when we took a look at the source code of most of the applications. Most applications did look horrible from the inside. And when we went to the high performance computing group and we told them, how are we supposed to compile this code? It doesn't even compile on our hosts. They would say, well, I'm not surprised. It's usual for most codes. And because it's hard to imagine how this or what this actually means, I would like to show you an example. This is an excerpt taken from AdCirc. And we will take a look at the code first. AdCirc was also one of the applications in the last student cluster competition. It is used to simulate coastal inundation. So you can simulate floodings, for instance, caused by hurricanes. But you can also simulate the seasons or tidal movement. But you can also move tsunamis with AdCirc if you want to. And what you can currently see is the file timestep.f, which is basically the inner kernel of the system. So if you're talking to a mathematician, mathematicians will typically assume the kernel of scientific simulation software is one numerical method, like conjugate gradients or something like that. So mathematicians will assume that you're solving one equation system. In this case, let's start at line one. The whole file is just slightly more than 9,000 lines of code. But it's actually not broken down into small subroutines. So in the end, you can see here one very short subroutine, all Fortran code. It's been in development since the beginning of the 90s, maybe even end of the 80s. So it's probably older than most of you are. And yeah, this is one short subroutine. So functions in Fortran are called not functions or methods, but subroutines. And this is nice, right? You can take a look at this and you can see, okay, here the input parameters are defined. Here I will do three assignments of temporal variables. I have one if condition, and based on that I will do different assignments to these two variables. Simple enough, right? But this is not the hotspot. This is not the function which is always being executed. This is the beginning of the subroutine time step, the function which is called for every single time step. What would you guess? How many lines of code does this function have? An upper limit is 9,000 because the file is no longer. So, but yep.
Half the file, so 4,000, 5,000.
Okay, 5,000. Any other takes?
8,000.
Okay. Any other take?
What is the current line number?
I'm right now in line 87.
Okay. So I think even more than 8,000, nearly close to 9.
Okay. Somewhere around. Okay. It's actually not that horrible. So this is the end of subroutine time step, and it's in line 3,378. So it's less than 4,000, but it's more than 1/3 of the file. And but if I'm programming, I typically try to keep my functions within about one screen of length. Because if I forget what's on top of the screen because I have to page down, I will probably forget what's happening inside the method. So you can assume that at least back in the 90s, there was no screen which was 3,000 lines high. There probably still isn't. Let me think about this. I think this screen gives me, right now it's about 45 lines, so if I was using a smaller font, it would probably be 60 lines. So then I can imagine that I would need 50 of these screens to fit the whole function on it. It's probably not realistic. Now if I skip through the function, I can see at the beginning I have a lot of variable definitions. It's just like O to C, you have to define all variables at the beginning of the function. And then what you can see here is, as I'm moving through the bottom of the code, you can see that the indentation gets larger. So I have, for instance, here in this case, I have an if statement which contains a do loop, but this if statement is also enclosed into something else. And I can't see on the screen what it is enclosed into. I'm not sure if it is conditional, if it is a loop, if it's multiple instances of that. And so what happens is developers get confused. They don't really remember where they are. They're not sure which code may I change. So what happens is they make changes, but they try to make those revertible. So stuff you will see is stuff like this. They will add preprocessor macros, if one, and this is the new code. This is always used, but this 46 user did not want this change to be permanent because maybe this is bogus. So I would like to be able to go back to this code which was there before. And so the actual code is full of stuff like this where people have made changes, but they weren't sure if this change is really correct. So they try to keep the old code as well. So if you can take a look, this change was made 2006. So somehow the decision seems to not have been made if this is a good change or not. And of course, this slows down modernizing the code. And I said before that I'm also part of a team which tries to modernize AdCirc. And the reason is we are cooperating with the Louisiana State University, and the LSU is cooperating with other universities from the US, and they are on the STORM project. If you end up working at the university later on and you write a grant application, always try to find a good acronym for your project name, because that way it will stick with the reviewers' names. Don't make it too complicated, don't make it too fancy. So it probably shouldn't be Master Storm or something like that. Just keep it plain, but something which is memorizable. And the Storm project actually aims at modernizing AdCirc, because the benefit of AdCirc is that the model itself is very good. I've now been dissing the code itself a lot, which is probably unfair because it was not written by a computer scientist, but by coastal engineers. And the actual beauty of AdCirc is that the model itself yields a high fidelity. It's better than most other models, which is probably what you want, because if there's a hurricane threatening the US coast, you probably want a model which can accurately predict what will happen at the coast. But then again, you also want a code which is probably efficient enough so you get the simulation results before the storm actually makes landfall. For evacuations, you probably remember the Hurricane Katrina, right, which hit New Orleans. if you want to evacuate a city, you have to do this 3 days in advance, because it takes so long to get everyone out of the city. And aside from this 72 hours window, you also have to know that per square mile which you are evacuating, you have to pay roughly $1 million, because it takes a lot of money to evacuate people. So if you think about a city which is just 10 by 10 miles large, and New Orleans is much larger, then you can also imagine that this costs hundreds of millions. So probably if you have to make that decision, you won't make this lightly. So you want a simulation software which is efficient, so you can get answers quickly, and which is also exact. This is exact, but it's also really slow. So what they are doing right now during hurricane season in the southern United States is they use simplified simulation models. They would, for instance, switch off the simulation of the waves, because that efficiently makes the code run twice as fast. And they would use smaller grids. So for instance, instead of simulating the whole southern coast, they would just simulate the coast of Louisiana or the coast of some other state right now. So they have to pull all sorts of tricks to make the code still run fast enough. And our goal in the Storm project is to modernize AdSorg so it won't just run faster, but that it will also scale onto larger systems, so they can actually use more exact meshes for the surface. Yeah, and this also means that I have to work with this code, which is sometimes horrible. Actually, modernizing this code does not mean to rewrite it completely, because we don't want to throw out all this. You can imagine if this code is so complicated and there are no unit tests, you cannot possibly imagine to rewrite it completely and get the exact same behavior without copying all of these different quirks of the system. So our goal is more or less to have a source translation facility which allows us to translate parts of the code and then allows us to apply certain transformations, but do this in an automated fashion so that coastal engineers can still continue to work on this code, perhaps clean it up a bit, perhaps add the numerical methods they need without having us to throw out everything, because if we did that, they probably wouldn't want to work with us again. Right? Yeah. And yeah, let's see how this works out. This project has begun just this year, so we don't have any results to show. But yeah, I'm slightly excited about it, because it's one of the few projects in high performance computing where you can see a direct impact from your work to everyday's life. Usually there's a lot of layers of abstraction between everyday's life and high performance computing. So for instance, you could say we are doing simulations for advanced material designs, but until these advanced materials hit the store, it will probably be 1 or 2 decades. But this is code which is actually being used for weather forecasts, for warning people. So there's a very immediate connection between everyday's life and high performance computing. And with this, I would like to close the lecture. Thank you for being here, and see you tomorrow for the exercises.